Hello, my name is Jonathan Bright. I have the privilege of serving as the Chief Administrator of Lincoln Charter. I have been with the school since 2007. The purpose of this podcast is to highlight some of the amazing staff and stakeholders that we have at Lincoln Charter and to share the college experiences of our guests. As we all know, college preparation is the goal of Lincoln Charter. I'm also a former middle school social studies teacher, so I'm always interested in storytelling and finding out more about the individuals that make Lincoln Charter a great school and community. So you may wonder, where does edge of the eyrie come from? You likely know that an eagle's nest is an eyrie, which obviously has meaning for our eagle nation. And I intend for this podcast to give you a perspective from the Lincoln Charter community. Therefore, each episode will come to you from the edge of the eyrie. As you likely know, Lincoln Charter is one of the oldest and largest public charter schools in North Carolina. We were founded in 1998, and we have a K-12 campus in Lincolnton and Tampa. All right, I want to welcome everyone to a special episode of The Edge of the Eyrie. We are, for context, we're recording this episode during the month of October, and many of you know that is Breast Cancer Awareness Month. This month has a special place in my heart because my mom and my mother-in-law are both breast cancer survivors, so it's a special time always for the Bryant family for that reason. As we start this next season of The Edge of the Eyrie, we thought it might be beneficial for our community to hear from some of our very own cancer survivors in an effort to promote general education on this topic, focus on early detection, prevention, and treatment. According to the V Foundation, a North Carolina-based cancer nonprofit, between 40 and 42% of individuals will be diagnosed with cancer in their lifetime. So it's a topic that will impact many of us if it has not already. We will be learning about the staff who are joining us today and hearing about their respective cancer journeys. So I'm excited to get to the guests for today's episode. And today I'm excited to be speaking with Miss Lail and Miss Boast, who are both going to joining us today. And as a bonus, we have a special guest interviewer who's going to assist with the conversation, and that is our very own Miss Helms. So as we get started, Miss Helms, if you can introduce yourself, tell us a little bit about yourself, what you do at the school, and kick us off.
I'm Taylor Helms. I am the Director of Advancement and Engagement at Lincoln Charter. I started here 13 years ago as an English teacher and really enjoyed that. And now I'm also the mom of two children in the elementary school.
Awesome. Ms. Lail?
Yes, I am Kathy Lail. I teach science, eighth grade science, at the Lincolnton campus here at Lincoln Charter. This is my sixth year at Lincoln Charter. Prior to that, I taught for 30 years in the North Carolina public school system, teaching science and English language arts. I was born in the South, Atlanta, Georgia, but I was primarily raised in Rockville, Maryland, outside of Washington, D.C. And in fact, I was just there this weekend for a little reunion, which was a lot of fun. But I've lived in Hickory, North Carolina for 35 years, been married to my husband for 30, and we have two sons, 22 and 27.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for joining us.
Mm-hmm. Glad to be here.
Ms. Post?
Hi, I'm Meredith Post. I'm a third grade teacher assistant at the Denver campus. This is my 14th year at Lincoln Charter. My girls started at Lincoln Charter in 2007 with a kindergartner and a fourth grader. So the kindergartner is a lifer and went all the way through. They're now 23, 27. And I have one getting married next year and one having a baby next year. So we have an exciting year ahead of us. I was born in Charlotte. I've lived in Charlotte all my life. I've been married for 32 years. We actually went to high school together and then went to UNCC together. I graduated from UNCC and I taught special ed in Charlotte Mink schools for 5 years. And then that's when I found out I was pregnant with my oldest. So I wanted to stay home, be a stay-at-home mom. And I did that for 14 years. And then, like I said, in 2007, when they got into Lincoln Charter, I was a room mom. I subbed, helped out. And then after 5 years, Dave Machado, our chief administrator, said, we need to employ you full-time. So in 2012, I started as a teacher assistant. So I wanted the flexibility to be able to go to my girls' sports, you know, be the mom at school also. Mm-hmm. So that teacher assistant position was perfect for me. Mm-hmm. I was in second grade for 13 years and I just graduated third grade.
So congratulations.
So you were identified for a job.
I was.
Just sort of. Yeah. That's
perfect.
That's good.
Yeah. That's perfect.
So this this podcast historically has been about college. And mm-hmm. so if you all can tell us a little bit about anything in college that helped you with your job or your life or anything that you did in college that was helpful or beneficial to you all.
You'd like. So when I graduated high school, I was determined to go to NC State. And I did, and I lasted 3 semesters. My major was zoology, which was not for me. And after 3 semesters, I transferred to UNCC because they have obviously a great education program. I mean, there are lots of teachers around here that graduated from UNCC. So my first route did not work out. And I think that's okay. I think kids want to go to college and think, I'm going to be here for 4 years. This is going to be great. And they get there and realize either the college is not for them, their major is not for them, something is just not their career path. And I think it's okay to change. And it's okay to make different decisions. So I dropped the zoology major after 3 semesters and a not very good GPA, transferred to UNCC and got in on their special education program. And at that time, it was very small. There were probably maybe 8 to 10 people in my classes, which was a good thing because the professors were all hands-on. And, you know, you have the book work and the book knowledge, but there were so many opportunities for us to go out in the community. And I wasn't sure which area of special ed I wanted to work in. So I worked with high schools in the transition department, teaching them how to fold towels and teaching them daily life skills. Then I was in a regular school setting in a resource classroom where, like what we have here, where the kids get pulled out into the classroom. And I realized elementary is where I needed to be. So
that's wonderful. Wonderful.
Thank you. Appreciate your time in education.
Thank you.
When it came time for me to apply to colleges, I was living in Maryland. I graduated from high school in Maryland, and I had a desire to stay close. University of Maryland was one of my choices. Towson State University was another choice. But it was my stepmother who said, you need to fly. You need to go. And I know you really want to go to North Carolina. And she said, you've talked about it. My brother was here in North Carolina attending school. So I applied and I got into Lenoir Rhyne University. And it being a Lutheran school, and I was wanting to, at that time in my life, strengthen my faith a little bit. And so that's one of the other pulls that drew me to Lenoir Rhyne. And so I decided ultimately to go there, 7 hours away from home. There were other things in my life that had occurred in high school that sort of gave me a little bit of, independence maybe. My mother passed away from breast cancer when I was 15. I was a sophomore in high school. And so I was the youngest at the time. And I say at the time because I now have a younger brother and sister who my father, after he remarried, had more children. But my sister and I were at home. My brother was away at school when she passed. And so my days consisted of going to school, after school practices for a dance team, coming home, cooking, cleaning, getting my homework done, and just doing it all over again the next day. So it was a lot. And my sister was there to help, of course. My father was there to help, but it was sort of like all hands on deck. And so that, I think, looking back now, was a terrible time. But at the same time, it really did teach me a lot about independence. Going to school 7 hours away, I was ready. I knew how to do my laundry where a lot of other kids didn't. I knew, you know, to just organize my time, prioritize things where a lot of other kids that I went to school with didn't. That actually helped quite a bit. I ended up, like you, changing a major, started out as one thing and, you know, ended up being an education major by the end of my sophomore year. I knew that that was really what I wanted to do. So I majored in middle grade education and I had 3 minors, communications, science, and Spanish. I ended up, you know, really pushing myself and really organizing and micromanaging my own time and things like that to get through it. And then when I graduated, I thought, okay, it's time to move back to Maryland, and that's where all my family is. And but there were no jobs, no teaching jobs to even interview for. And they had, you know, they just did not in anywhere in Maryland or in the, you know, area of the District of Columbia. So I got an interview. I got two interviews here locally in Catawba County. So I took them and I was offered a job. And then I just stayed here, met my husband, and, you know, the rest is history, as they say. But yeah, college really helped shape a lot of my career path. It's been a great ride.
Appreciate your service.
Thank you.
So you went into college knowing some of the things that people learn in college,
yes,
like how to take care of yourself, mm-hmm, figure out your own groceries and laundry.
Right.
What were some of the things, aside from that, that you were able to learn while you were there? Some of the soft experiences, like your extracurriculars or anything that you got to do that was different than home, since you were already sort of taking care of things in a way most students aren't when they go to college.
Right. In college, I decided to get more involved in things. I was in a sorority, and that sorority was very philanthropic. So we were doing a lot of charity work, which I really enjoyed that. But I really took, I was even on the intramural teams, if you can believe it. I played intramural football as the tight end. So, and soccer. And so doing those things really gave me an outlet to, you know, just give me some time where I wasn't really committed and always doing my work and always doing homework and always studying and things like that. So I did learn to, I learned to balance a little bit more, I think. I didn't have to have friends that came knocking on my door and said, look, you really need to get away from studying and go out. You know, we need to do something. You need a break. They didn't have to do that because I knew to give myself that break. And I think balance is a lot of what students need to learn in college. You are budgeting, doing your own laundry, like you said, doing your own shopping, going to class, you know, doing your studies, but you have to find that balance, if nothing else, for your own mental health too. And so I was able to learn that in college, which was really key, because in high school, that's what was missing for me, was a balance of a social life, a bit of a social life. I didn't really take the time to go out with my friends quite as much as maybe I should have.
You almost got the reverse experience to like learn to have a little fun rather than where most students are learning to buckle down.
Yes, that's exactly what my stepmother has told me in the past. She said, you did this in reverse.
What about you?
To feed off of what she said, I mean, I did go to college knowing how to do my laundry and, you know, being a good student and studying and knowing how to manage your time. But I think it's also a good place to make mistakes. I mean, you can make mistakes, and then you need to figure out how to solve your mistakes and how to solve your problems. And without, you know, you have mom and dad behind you if you need to pick up the phone and to call them. But, you know, your first defense is to figure it out for yourself. And I'm out of money. What am I going to do? You know, my next paycheck doesn't come for 2 weeks. How am I going to survive? And then when that next 2 weeks come, you've learned not to do what you did the last time.
Right.
You know, and they're tough lessons. And that's kind of a safe zone, a safe space that you can make mistakes without being detrimental when you have a husband and you have kids. And it's 4 years of a learning experience before the real world.
Right. I agree. Period.
And, you know, you go to college and you don't like your major. What do you do? I mean, I was terrified. My parents were going to be mad at me. They paid money for me to go to college, and I pretty much wasted a year and a half. And they weren't, well, we had 24 hours. We were a little difficult. I threw in an engagement in there, too. So there was a lot happening that Christmas.
Oh, that's a fact.
Yes. But, I mean, I transferred to UNCC, and they said, that's great. Now you have to pay for it. So I had to figure out how to come up with the money to pay for it and how to get loans and how to manage that money and how to not waste the money. And, you know, all of a sudden you're in charge of your education.
And I agree. I agree with you about the mistakes. I think more and more it's important that even down to middle school and high school, they need to make mistakes, and students need to make mistakes and figure out, how do I fix it? And, you know, parents, teachers, everybody, friends are around to support them, but inevitably they have to look in the mirror and say, how am I going to fix this? Because one day it's going to come to that. And the more they can equip themselves with those skills going into college, the more successful they will be, in my opinion. So I totally agree with you.
Great. Well, we are very thankful for those experiences that led you here to us. And at Lincoln Charter, there are some go-to people when it's Breast Cancer Awareness Month, like it is now, or Pink Out, or I know you do some things here in Lincolnton. So can you share a bit about your health background and how you kind of came to hold that spot in our hearts at Lincoln Charter?
So my story started back in November 2013, and I just went for a regular mammogram. I was 43, so I went at 40, 41, 42. I mean, I got my yearly mammograms, and a spot showed up on the mammogram. The doctor could not feel it. It was 11 millimeters, so it was really tiny. Nobody could feel it. So that was in November. I had surgery January 2nd of that year, and then had a lumpectomy. Mine was small and contained, so it had not spread. It wasn't in my lymph nodes. So I chose to have a lumpectomy, and then I did 7 weeks of radiation, which hopefully cut the rest of it. And then for 5 years, I did hormone treatment. So I took medicine. I took tamoxifen to block my estrogen because my cancer was estrogen driven. So I had stage one ductal carcinoma. So it was in like the milk ducts.
Okay.
And I really had no symptoms. I had no risk factors. All the things they tell you, if you nurse your babies, you have a less chance of having breast cancer. If you have your kids before you're 30, you have a less chance. I mean, I was 28, no medical history. I did the genetic testing. I had none of the genetics. Nobody in my family had cancer. I mean, everybody was shocked because I'm like, well, nobody in our family has cancer. Where did it come from? Which leads to a whole nother question. So I was in treatment from beginning to end. I was in treatment for about 6 months.
And again, congratulations. Mom.
Thank you.
Congrats.
Thank
for
you.
Sure.
It was wonderful. My cancer was diagnosed in August of 2015. I had colon cancer, colorectal cancer. I was 47. I was diagnosed with a stage 2B, which 2B indicates in colon cancer that it had not spread. We didn't know that at the initial diagnosis, of course. The reason I went, I'll never forget the day I was actually at my physician's office just getting my, in the summer of 2015, getting my regular checkup. And I saw this poster of Katie Couric and encouraging people to get their colon screenings. And I don't know if anybody remembers, but she had her colonoscopy live on the Today Show one day years before that. And I thought, oh, yeah, Katie, I got to ask about that because I did have a family history, not of colon cancer, but colon polyps. My grandmother had many polyps. My father, my uncle all had polyps in their 40s, their late 40s. So I said something to my physician, my regular physician, about that. And she said, you probably should have already had a colonoscopy, but let's get you in now. Because at that time, prior to being 50, unless you had symptoms, which I did not, you had to have a doctor's referral for a reason to have a colonoscopy before 50. So she gave me the referral. They called me. They had an opening. And I was getting the colonoscopy 2 weeks later. So my doctor, Gail Richardson, she's in Hickory, came into the room and said, when I was getting the colonoscopy, she said, well, what brings you here today? Because you're only 47. And I told her the whole family history. She said, I'm glad you're being proactive. I'm sure we're going to be fine. So come out of it. And, you know, I don't know if anybody at this table has had a colonoscopy, but you're a little loopy when you come out. It's the best sleep you ever have. And she took a long time to come in the room. My husband said later, she took a long time to come in the room. And that's when she said, well, we found 5 polyps and we found a mass. And she started, and all I heard was mass after that. And I said, whoa, 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 whoa. I said, Dr. Richardson, are you telling me that I have colon cancer? She said, I am telling you, you have colon cancer. And so that began the journey, which that was not at all on my radar. Unlike you, I did have a family history of breast cancer. I had an aunt and my mother died of breast cancer. My older sister and I were always very good about doing the monthly breath checks on the 6th of the month and, you know, calling each other or texting each other to say, do this. And that was never on my radar. Colon cancer was never on my radar. And so I followed up with liver scans, which showed that
there wasn't a spread. It was contained, thankfully. I saw two after my, I had a surgery that removed a foot of my colon, and that remedied the cancer. So that got rid of the cancer. After that, seeing two oncologists, they really advised me, along with my surgeon, I didn't really need the chemo or radiation simply because it would only decrease my chance or decrease my chances of a recurrence by maybe 6 or 7%. Oh, I said 6, 7. Anyway, 6 or 7%. Sorry. You can scratch that one.
You're in middle school.
Absolutely not. Anyway, so we decided, you know, not to do that and that I would just have colonoscopies every few years. So I have a colonoscopy every 2 years. So over the past 10 years since I've been cancer-free, I've had 6 colonoscopies, and I am a testament that they're not that bad because people just do not like to have them for different reasons, but they really are not that bad. I looked at the statistics every year, and colon cancer has now, it's on the rise, and it's second to the deaths causing cancer. Lung cancer is first, colon cancer is second. There are more people diagnosed with breast cancer, but more people are surviving it. Mm-hmm. But there are fewer people diagnosed with colon cancer, but more people are dying from that. And I have a feeling that's because people wait until they're really advanced and they don't know it. They show symptoms and they ignore it in their digestive system. And, you know, that's so I'm a huge advocate for awareness.
Absolutely. So, well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah. Congrats. That's, you never know sort of what might come up during an interview like this. And super interesting that neither of you had sort of indications going into a routine medical experience and was able to uncover something that changed your life in a lot of ways. Right.
And even going into my surgery, when I was at the school, I was at Northview Middle School at the time, very supportive staff. And like you, they said to me, well, how can that be? You're like one of the healthiest people on the staff. You know, I don't understand how you can get cancer. And they would say, well, how are you feeling? And I would just say, I feel great, but apparently I have cancer. I mean, I have no symptoms. And even going into the surgery, never any symptoms.
You both touched a little bit on the treatment after the initial diagnosis. Can you talk a little bit about sort of the how that conversation with your respective doctors went and the different options or sort of advice that you got, and maybe even touch on how does that carry through to today? What is the doctor's advice today as you're moving forward in your journey?
Well, I had, pretty much right after you're diagnosed, like I had a, ultrasound and I was diagnosed and, you know, you kind of know something's going on because they're taking a little bit longer doing the ultrasound, talking and leaving the room and coming back. And then they say, we'll see you in 2 days for the test results. Well, I already told my husband, I was like, I mean, I know I have breast cancer. And he's like, how do you know? I mean, I don't know. Just the way they're acting, the way they're doing the test, and they did lots of tests and lots of biopsies and, you know, things are clicking. They're writing things down. It just seems like they're doing more than they should be doing. So when we went back and pretty much sat across the table from us and said, well, you do have breast cancer and we have some options. And I had a nurse navigator that put everything together for me. And then he said, and this is your nurse navigator, and she's going to talk to you and get everything together, get all your appointments and answer all your questions. And then the radiologist got up and left. So I really talked to him for like 2 minutes, long enough for him to say, you have breast cancer. And then he left. But I had an amazing nurse navigator. And right after the radiologist left, we sat down in her office and she picked up the phone and she called the surgeon. She called to get me an MRI. She called to get genetic testing. I mean, we were in the office for, I don't know, 2 or 3 hours setting up appointments immediately right after I found out I was diagnosed. Which is incredible because, like you said, you're shocked. What do you do? Where do I go first? Who do you call? Where do you begin? So that was awesome to have somebody set everything up because you're just your head spinning.
Never done it before. Right?
Yeah, I don't know how to do this. And then we met with the surgeon. I had all the MRI, I had the genetic testing, had everything, and we meet with the surgeon and He said, you have two choices. You can have a mastectomy or you can have a lumpectomy. And I'd always said, I mean, I kind of knew people that had had breast cancer, and I'd always said I'd have, you know, I'd do a mastectomy, never thought twice about it. But then all of a sudden you're in that situation, and it had not spread. So it was still contained. It was very small. And at the last minute, I just kind of switched and decided, I think I'll try the lumpectomy.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the recovery is completely different. Did not stay in the hospital. I think my surgery was an hour, mm-hmm. and I was home lying on the couch for 3 days. I had my surgery on a Thursday, and I came back to school on Monday, which I probably should not have come back that quick. I think I stayed half a day and went home. You know, just lots of decisions, lots of unknowns. Here's a book, read a book. And I will have to say my husband read all the books. You know, I'm trying to read the books, but I also have two kids, one elementary, one middle school, running cross country, playing tennis, playing soccer.
Right.
Cooking dinner. Yeah. I mean, you still have to be mom, you know, you still have to do all of that stuff. So he kind of did the research for me and got on the internet, changed our whole food diet. And I'm not saying we're 100% healthy food every day. I still eat Chick-fil-A. You know,
I still drink a Coke.
But, you know, it made us really think about the food
mm-hmm.
that you put in your body. I mean, because the biggest question is,
How did you get it?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Nobody knows how you got it. Like I said, I did not have any of the factors. So then you have to look at environmental factors. Mm-hmm. I mean, is it our air? Is it our water? Is it our food? And some things you can control and some things you can't control. So if we can control the things we put in our body and control the exercise and,
mm-hmm.
you know, but I feel like anything you can do to help is better than not doing anything at all.
That is true. When I was diagnosed, my gastroenterologist, you know, right after she gave us the news, said, I'm going to go schedule an MRI for your liver. You're going to go tomorrow at the hospital, get that done, and I'm going to contact your surgeon for you. She'll be in touch, you know, that kind of thing. So I really trusted my two main physicians, my gastroenterologist and my colorectal surgeon. And I decided going home that day and giving ourselves time to process, I was just like you said, in shock. And then I got really mad for reasons that, you know, probably applies to another question later, but I got really angry, as anybody would. So by the time I woke up the next morning, I thought, you know, I really need for my own peace of mind, to get a specialist. So I got online and I started researching and I found one in Winston and I thought to myself, this is my surgeon. And I just liked her bio. And as soon as I met her, she was very, very warm and kind. Not that all doctors have to have a great bedside manner. You want the smartest. Sometimes you want that smartest one that's a little nerdy and doesn't really communicate all that well, and that's okay. But there was just, I don't know, just alarms that went off that she was the one. Mine was a much longer surgery, much longer recovery. It was a 6-hour surgery. She had taken some lymph nodes while she was removing the part of my colon. And then I stayed in the hospital for 5 days. And the lymph nodes all came back negative. So for a spread. Following up with that, I got a phone call a couple weeks after, or maybe a week or so after I got home. And it was from a biologist in Winston-Salem. And she said, you are a good candidate for genetic testing. And she said, normally people would pay for this, but because it was not related to breast cancer, it was really relative to the colon cancer genes. And she said, but you fall under the umbrella of this study that's being funded. So she said, if you want to do this, we need permission for you to release your records and everything and your samples. So I did. And I screened 29 panels. And I, like you, didn't have any genetic colon cancer. Prove that which is what my gastroenterologist and my surgeon thought initially, that a polyp that probably started growing in my late 30s or early 40s. And colon cancer is a very slow growing cancer, but it stayed there and it developed into a mass. So the cancer was not genetic, it was just the polyps. And had I not known my family history, had I not gone when I was 47, had I waited until I was 50, I probably would have showed symptoms of colon cancer before 50. So you mentioned some understandable anger about your diagnosis, and you mentioned the challenge of being a mom while trying to take care of yourself. What was the hardest part emotionally, physically, mentally for you during that time?
Probably telling my kids.
Yeah, telling it was my boys. For me, it was they know the story of my mom. And they knew that because I raised them knowing my mother, even though they never got to meet her since she died when I was 15. And I knew when I had to tell my boys that that was going to be where their minds went first was, oh, no, what happened to my mother as a child or as a teen is going to happen to me, because my boys were 12 and 17. And my older son, especially, he was starting his senior year. It was 2 weeks before his senior year launched. And that was really, really hard. That's the main anger. And I remember thinking to myself, I thought I've done everything right. You know, like you said earlier, eating right, exercising, because I was always aware of my chance of breast cancer because of my family history. And I remember thinking, you have to be kidding me. I mean, this cannot happen again. And so it was telling the kids was the hardest. And when you're a mom, it's all about your children. It's always all about your children and protecting your children, no matter how old they are. That's, you know, so my husband, of course, was right by my side. I realized later also in, you know, in this, and your husband, I don't know if he ever felt this way, but when you get cancer, when you get in our situation, it's always about us and, you know, about the kids. And I realized afterwards, did anybody check on my husband? Because that's a struggle for the spouse as well. And I remember asking him, and he just kind of chuckled and teared up, and he said, yeah, but I'm okay, but I'm glad you're asking, because a lot of people didn't. And he had to just, you know, take over and go all in and, you know, protect his children and his wife and as much as he could. But nobody, you know, I wondered, was anybody checking on him?
And I think having, like, my husband was so involved and, like, took over like the healthy eating and went to the grocery store and cooked and made sure, you know, we got out and did walks and exercised, and like it gave him a purpose. It gave him something to do. But yeah, my girls were 10 and 14. So middle school, high school. And you know, the first thing they think of is not a good thought.
Right.
So, you know, we had to reassure them.
Yes. Yeah. And it was that reassurance, and it was hard for them. I mean, and it's still hard sometimes for my boys, even though they're 22 and 27, it's hard for them to still kind of talk about it and think about it, because every year or every 2 years when I have my colonoscopy, their minds go back to that. Are they going to find more cancer?
Right.
And I know that they don't say that out loud, but I know that that's in the back of their minds. Mm-hmm. I know they're thinking it. And my husband, too.
It used to be you could go get your mammogram and they give you your results, like right then and there. But after you get so many years out, they make you wait.
So they do make you wait.
Mm-hmm. The anxiety of going and waiting, you know, and everybody says it'll be fine. It's going to be fine. But
once you've been through it, you don't.
But it's not been fine before.
Right.
You know.
And when you mentioned the genetic testing, one of the things that the biologist that did my genetic testing, oddly enough, she ended up, when I walked in, it was one of my former students, which was really great. Yes. And she was living in Winston, you know, doing this job. And I think she's since moved. But she assured me, she said, you know, we do the genetic testing for research purposes, she said, and this was in 2015. Of course, the statistics change. But she said, most cancers like yours are not genetic. She said, most people, when they get cancer, it is not genetic. It is environmental. It is environmental, which a lot of people know. We still need to take care of ourselves regardless if it's in our genes or if we have a family history or not. We still need to be on the lookout for it, but everybody does. And it's like everyone should be really good about their mammograms or their colonoscopies or any other screening that they need, you know, for prostate cancer, things like that. We all need to be more aware because most of it is not genetic. I mean, the amount of people that have said to me, when I've said, oh, you're 50, have you had your colonoscopy? Oh, I don't have any family history of colon cancer. Neither did I.
Neither did me. Yeah.
Neither did I, is my response. And So it is really important to just be aware. So.
And you mentioned prostate cancer. So 5 years ago, my husband was diagnosed with prostate cancer. Mm-hmm. But he's in a maintenance level now to where, you know, he still goes to the doctor and has tests done. But his numbers are steady and good.
It's good.
We just wait each year and see what happens. You know, take our vitamins and our supplements
right.
and eat good food and go from there.
Yes.
Well, I hear strong advocacy for Ms. Layla. I think you used the word proactive mm-hmm. and taking control of your own, what you can control within your life. So I'm hearing that loud and clear from both of you.
Yes. So get your screenings.
I have had my colonoscopy within the last year or so. So not as bad as some would say.
No. So given your experience with cancer, how has that changed your outlook on life in general after cancer?
The decisions to do things that we want to do, you know, the things that seem far-fetched, just do them. Mm-hmm. I mean, nobody's promised tomorrow. So we actually ended up buying a little beach cottage a year ago, and we went back and forth. Do we do it? Do we not do it? Is this the right time? You know, the whole money thing, it only has 2 bedrooms, so it doesn't house our whole family. Do we look for something bigger? And one morning we woke up and we're like, but we're just going to do it. You know, take the family trips, buy, you know, do the vacations, buy the beach house. You're not promised tomorrow. Mm.
One of the things that I kept in my head when I went through this journey was that cancer better get out of my way because I'm not finished yet. So just move over and let me by. And I kept that, you know, afterwards even and still today. So it's just a thought process that, you know, once you go through this journey and once really everybody should realize is, yeah, you aren't promised tomorrow. And I know that as overused as it may sound, you do need to just sometimes step out of your comfort zone and do things maybe that you've wanted to do, but you know it's going to push you a little, whether it's rock climbing, skydiving, which no, I don't want to do that, but I did rock climb, you know, and like things like take the trip, spend the time with the family, you know, buy the dog, things like that. So it's just a sense of, you know, I just got to do as much as I want to do, as much as going to make me happy, what's going to bring me peace and joy and fulfillment and focus on that. That's what I do. I mean, I love my church. I love my church family. They really helped me through this. I spend a lot of time there and volunteering a lot there. And that's a lot of my fulfillment. And as well as other advocacy groups like colon cancer awareness and the charity walks, Get Your Rear in Gear, the breast cancer walks, Susan Komen, you know, getting that fulfills me oddly enough. It just makes me feel like I've got a purpose and I'm doing something right. Mm. Not just for myself, but for others.
I had a small group at my church that really came through after I had surgery. And, you know, of course, they brought meals and showed up at the hospital when I had surgery, but also helped by Christmas presents because I had my surgery right. Mm-hmm. Well, all this was going on right at Thanksgiving and Christmas. But, you know, help put up a Christmas tree, help bake, help do all that stuff. And, you know, that was 13 years ago. And our little small group, still, we pick up the phone. We may not talk to each other on a daily basis, but we can pick up the phone and say, hey, we need to get together. And then, of course, the support at school. You know, my team at school covered car duty, making copies, taking kids out to recess. I mean, mm-hmm. all this stuff. When I left to do radiation, I mean, I was gone 2 hours, 3 hours every day at school, and somebody had to be there to cover for me. Nobody complained. You know, they just jumped up and did it for you.
And they do. That's what we do as mm-hmm. humans. That's mm-hmm. what we're meant to do. So, yeah.
I could spend the rest of the day with two of you all. It's great, great advice. Is there anything else you'd like for our audience to know about your experience or anything else that we haven't covered?
One thing I'd like to mention is I'm so glad I'm doing this interview with you both. And it is October Breast Cancer Awareness Month. And I'd like people to remember March. March is Colon Cancer Awareness Month. The color is blue. You know, you had mentioned earlier that I try to, each March, I try to send out little anecdotes and statistics and things like that about colon cancer to just raise awareness. It seems to be permeating into the younger generation, which is not a good thing. A lot of listeners might know Chadwick Boseman, who played the Black Panther, of course, was diagnosed when he was in his late 30s and lost that battle. And that really struck me very, very hard because one, I love the Black Panther. That's my favorite superhero. And two, the age at which he was. I just want everybody to be more aware of it, that it is on the rise and it needs some attention. So.
And I'm glad you did this because October is breast cancer awareness and we always do pink, but there's so many other cancers around that have colors and like, you know, the month of March, but just don't get as much attention as the breast cancer does. So it's nice to bring awareness of other cancers so we can get those screenings. So hopefully, you know, you said colorectal cancer is the number one. Mm-hmm. So obviously there need to be lots of education, lots of screenings.
Don't ignore your digestive health.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Love that you're a science teacher.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And your former student ended up being someone taking care of you.
Yes.
That's like the most literal sense of what we say about teachers is that,
right,
you know, you're training your future doctors and mm-hmm. lawyers and all the people that you're going to need when you're older. And that.
Yeah.
That so really specifically great. Happened.
That was
for
really
you.
Great. And she was just out of grad school. And I walked into the office and she knew I was coming. I didn't know that it was going to be her. Mm-hmm. And so when I walked in, it was such a surprise, brought tears to my eyes because yet I thought again, I really feel like that was God's intervention, putting me in the hands of these women that knew what they were doing. And I trusted so much. I mean, because you just have to trust them. And it was just, it was a really sweet moment. It was a really, really good moment. So, and I'm so proud of her.
That's great. Just as a former mm-hmm. teacher and a mom, I just feel so like happy for you that you have the platform of being a teacher and to, you know, you talked about the younger generations and being able to make them more aware. I guess I think you're really, that's mm-hmm. such a great way to get to continue to live after beating cancer.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. One of the words that I have thought about during this conversation is you both are great role models. And that's what we hope our educators are, obviously. And life is not always easy, bump free. There's a lot of things that can happen outside of our control, but I appreciate you being willing to share this, your stories and how you overcame this. Congratulations to both of you.
Thank you.
So thank you for being an inspiration for me personally, for our community,
yes.
And just appreciate you being willing to spend the time to talk about this, emphasize early detection, prevention, and treatment. And so hopefully that will be full for our audience. I want to thank and shout out to the medical professionals that you both have mentioned, your school families and your actual families too, because that certainly is a big part of sort of overcoming the situations. So it was a pleasure to get to know both of you a little bit better too. Appreciate all of your hard work and your contributions to the Lincoln Charter experience. I want to thank our listeners for listening to this special episode. If you're interested in more information about cancer, you'd like to help out in some way, you can visit v.org. Are there any other resources or websites that you all would recommend?
There's the Colon Cancer Awareness website. They have their own website.
Okay.
And then if anyone's interested in finding a fundraiser, Get Your Rear in Gear has its own website.
Okay.
And they usually have a walk in Charlotte and in Winston-Salem, I believe, each year.
Great.
I know our school raises money for the organization Go Gen Go.
Mm-hmm.
So I know there's a lot of information on that website.
Great. This is Jonathan and Taylor signing off. Thanks for listening to Edge of the Eerie.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I want to thank all of our listeners and subscribers for listening to The Edge of the Eerie. Like everything at LCS, it takes a great team to make this podcast happen. The Edge of the Eerie is produced by Jonathan Bryant and Taylor Helms, and additional support from our advancement and engagement team is very appreciated. Graphics and artwork are by Melissa Lasarski, and our music is brought to you by Next Mic. who you might also know as Michael Paulino Albin. Our team uses the free Spotify for Creators app to record and produce each episode, which is found at creators.spotify.com. You can listen to this podcast on Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Feel free to subscribe, rate, and or review the podcast. It may help others to discover this content. This is Jonathan Bryant, signing off. Until next time.